Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 232, Hiking with Buddha.
We're hiking in the Catskills, right? And so how many have read the Vimalakirti or looked at it? Not too many. Where it's an unusual sutra because it's called the Arya Vimalakirti Nirdesha Sutra. And it is among the sutras where Buddha himself does not teach the whole sutra. He gives some teachings in the sutra. And most sutras in Buddhism, it has a slightly different meaning in Hinduism. But in Buddhism, sutra means is a discourse of the Buddhas. And it corresponds as text to the meditation education. Because it's believed that when a Buddha speaks, that we go into a meditation of entering the mind of the Buddha. Because speech is considered so valuable among a special gift of human beings. Because when we speak, we share minds. And like when you speak, you share your mind with me. When I speak, I share my mind with you. When Buddha speaks, this is ultimate reality. This is the absolute. This is nirvana now. And we've always been here, actually. And we cannot leave because it's the absolute. It is everything. It's like infinity. You feel, I'm finite. What do you mean, I'm finite? But actually, we are infinity. Because infinity is completely permeates us, right? If it was excluded from being in our finitude, then it wouldn't be infinity, right? It would be barred from being us. So we are all infinite, actually. And we all meet in this dimension of infinity. Like the Tathagata is in suchness where we all are. We're all in suchness, in fact. So he's not a limit beyond us, that means. He's not relating to ultimate reality. He is ultimate reality. He is not produced from causes, nor does he depend on conditions. Because nirvana is not produced. That's why it's ultimate reality, absolute reality. And it doesn't depend on conditions. It is the actual nature of anything without any kind of problem about it. He is not without any characteristic, nor has he any characteristics. He's not some sort of an entity that has no characteristics, nor does he possess any, because he is all characteristics. He has no single nature, nor any diversity of natures, nor has any. He is not a conception, not a mental construction, nor is he a non-conception. You know, he's not noise, and he's not silence. You know, he's not quiet. He's neither the other shore, nor this shore, nor that between. He is neither here nor there nor anywhere else. He is neither this nor that. He cannot be discovered by consciousness, nor is he inherent in consciousness. He is neither darkness nor light. He is neither name nor sign. He is neither weak nor strong. He lives in no country or direction. He is neither good nor evil. He is neither compounded nor uncompounded. He cannot be explained as having any meaning whatsoever. Stan, you wanted the inconceivable. The Tathagata, the suchness understander, that is, the suchness realizer, is neither generosity nor avarice, neither morality nor immorality. Neither tolerance nor malice, neither effort nor sloth, neither concentration nor distraction, neither wisdom nor foolishness. He is inexpressible. He is neither truth nor falsehood, neither escape from the world nor failure to escape from the world, neither cause of involvement in the world nor not cause of involvement in the world. He is the cessation of all theory and all practice. He is neither a field of merit nor not a field of merit. He is neither worthy of offerings nor unworthy of offerings. He is not an object and cannot be contacted. He is not a whole, not a conglomeration. He surpasses all calculations. He is utterly unequaled, yet equal to the ultimate reality of things. He surpasses all measure. He does not go, does not stay, does not pass beyond. He is neither seen, heard, distinguished, nor known. He is without any complexity, having attained the equanimity of omniscient gnosis. Equal toward all things, he does not discriminate between them. He is without reproach, without excess, without corruption, without conception, and without intellectualization. He is without activity, without birth, without occurrence, without origin, without production, and without non-production. He is without fear and without subconsciousness, without sorrow, without joy, and without strain. No verbal teaching can express him. Such is the body of the Tathagata, and thus should he be seen. Who sees thus truly sees. Who sees otherwise sees falsely. So that's Vimalakirti standing in front of Buddha. In a sense, it's an amazing meeting of the two, like a non-duality of the two. Because in a way, he's saying that the Buddha is also me, as well as you. And he's everyone here. And but he's everyone here in a dimension that their ignorance prevents them from seeing. And therefore, that's why I'm having to talk about it, he's saying. Even though my talk cannot capture it. It's so funny. Recently, I spoke, not recently, but a year or two ago, to someone who thinks he's enlightened. And I said, didn't you ever read in the Mahayana Sutras about how, like, you cannot be discovered by consciousness, nor is it inherent in consciousness? Didn't you ever read things like that? I didn't use this passage, but there's many others. Oh, I never noticed that. The guy's supposed to be a scholar of Buddhism and thinks he got enlightened because he had an experience of disappearing, which you can have. It's not a big deal. We do it every night when we fall asleep. Thank heaven. We all disappear. What's the big deal? So this guy's meditating. Bing, he disappeared. He comes back. And then, eureka, I disappeared. Therefore, I'm enlightened. If you think you have nirvana, you don't. You can only enjoy the nirvana that is your own reality by surrendering all kinds of other delusions, including a delusion that, oh, now I'm in nirvana. That's amazing. So this is, we're starting right out with the heavy wisdom thing. John asked yesterday about how can there be any rebirth when there's no soul? And I said, and you know, here he's saying there's no Buddha, by the way. The guy who said there's no souls, you don't have to listen to that. Just kidding. So, point is, I explained to him that in the no self, and the no soul type of diction that Buddha gets into in some moods when he's pressing on this kind of side of things, you know, the critiquing everything that we hold on to, then he does say no self. And which that means that my relative self is not the absolute that my ego wants to think it is. That's what I mean. It doesn't mean I don't have a relative self. Or even a relative ego. Buddhists never said you have to lose your ego, that thing. Because you can't, you shouldn't lose your ego. Ego is just a pronoun. It's the Greek pronoun. When you go into a shop in Greece to order some like rice pudding with cinnamon on top, you say, ego wants some cinnamon. And they don't think you're being egotistical. They think you're a good customer. Because ego means I. And then, and even Freud, when he started this whole contraption about the ego, he was using in German the ich. Yeah, that's right. Everybody has an ich. Sounds icky, doesn't it? No, I'm sorry. But anyway, everybody has an ich. And then the English guy, he didn't want to go around saying the I. So he wanted to, because he wanted to sound technical. You know, Thomas, whatever his name was, Kemp or something. So he said, he used the Greek word, you know. That's how doctors make their living. They go around telling you have like a rash on your skin. They go, Skinopolis, Monopolis. And you see, oh, wow. They did some heavy research to discover that. Meanwhile, it just sees you have a rash on your leg. And gives you the Greek word for it. It is wonderful, though. I once was in Greece with a bunch of Greeks. and they would occasionally deign to speak to me in English, but most of more often, they would chat with each other at dinner and at this and that. And it was like, I thought I was like sitting around a table with a bunch of nuclear physicists or something. Because everything they talk about is epsis and opsis and skepsis and scopsis. And you think like it's really, really high tech. It's like super scientific. You know, and they're just talking about the cheese and the wine and whatever. It's great, and I love it. So then Buddha is happy with that. He doesn't say anything, you know. And then he's in this mood, Vimalakirti writes, so Shariputra is upset because he's just seen the Buddha deconstructed in front of his face. You know, standing there, Buddha loves it. Yeah, I'm not Buddha. In other words, this is just a manifestation. Because it's a being who, when you become Buddha, you're beyond your body. You can manifest a body. You can have many bodies simultaneously. In the Matrix, did you notice that? That at the later ones, he would have many bodies. And he even gave the devil, you know, the bad guy, the ability to do that. Right? But then when he defeated the devil, it's where he became the devil. And the devil then became him and couldn't be bad anymore. Well, it's quite bright, actually. It was really teaching an interesting message, that movie. So when he's in that mood, then Shariputra says, Lord, in which Buddha field did the noble Vimalakirti die before reincarnating in this Buddha field? And then the Buddha says to him, Shariputra, ask this good man directly himself, ask him where he died to reincarnate here. So then the Venerable Shariputra asked the Lichabhi Vimalakirti, noble sir, where did you die to reincarnate here? And Vimalakirti declared, is there anything among the things that you see, elder, that dies or is reborn? So now we're getting into this like nirvanic vision, because he's in the vision that this all is absolute, and really the birth and death of things is illusory. You know, it's not really happening, actually. It's unreally happening, but not really happening. And he's in that mood of the reality level. So he says, have you ever seen... And Shariputra is very wise and has seen the world in a certain way. And so he has to say no, even though he is actually seeing it. But he says, no, I didn't, he says. There's nothing that dies or is reborn. Likewise, Reverend Shariputra, as all things neither die nor are reborn, why do you ask where did you die to reincarnate here? Reverend Shariputra, if one were to ask a man or woman created by a magician where he or she had died to reincarnate there, what do you think he or she would say? Noble sir, a magical creation does not die nor is it reborn. Reverend Shariputra, did not the Tathagata declare that all things have the nature of a magical creation? Yes, noble sir, that is indeed so. So he gets scolded again. Poor Vimalakirti. So then Buddha has to intervene because Shariputra still wants to know where Vimalakirti came from in a relative sense. So then the Buddha said to Venerable Shariputra, Shariputra, this holy person came here from the presence of the Tathagata Akshobhya in the universe Abhidhati. Abhidhati means intense delight. And Akshobhya is the Buddha in the eastern direction. And so then they go on. Then eventually, Vimalakirti brings this Buddha land of Akshobhya into the Buddha land, into Shakyamuni's Buddha land, and shows it to people like a miniature thing, like Men in Black. Remember, there was a whole universe in a little thing around the neck of the cat? Remember that? Some of you should watch more movies. He said, well, no, there's a lot of deep teaching in the movies. There was a whole universe in a little amulet around the cat's neck. So Vimalakirti shows this universe, the whole universe like that. Anyway, that's a marvelous thing. Oh, but I was saying about being reborn. That's good for everyone to know. So therefore, we have a soul in Buddhist physics and biology. We have three levels of our body and mind. We have the coarse body and mind. We have what's called the subtle body and mind. And we have the extremely subtle body and mind. And the coarse body and mind is the coarse body is the flesh and blood body, or they more normally say the body which is the five senses. You know, because the skin, the whole skin, is a such sense, you know. And then the mind of that is the consciousness that coordinates all the stimuli and input of the senses. You know, and also the sixth sense, which is the thinking sense, which coordinates the inputs of the different senses, right? So the manas, the which in a way is like the ego sense, the pronominally organized sense of personality. And that's the coarse mind, right? Then the subtle mind and body, the subtle body is called winds, drops, and channels. And winds just means energies. And it's like, it's not just the breathing, it's also the digestive, what moves the bloodstream, you know, electricity in the nervous system, all of that, they call it wind, neural wind. You could, so it's really energy, what it's movement. And so we're just these winds, that these energies that move, these movements in our body, and then there are some what are called drops, which are like endocrine things, which connected with winds create consciousness. And then there's the channels, which is a kind of, we're like a gyroscope, you know, with the chakras and the 72,000 nerves that connect the different petals of the different chakras, going up and down a central channel with a right and left channel, like that. And the subtle mind is marvelous. The subtle mind going with that subtle body is called the mind of the three luminances. And they are when the coarse mind, you get out of the sense perceptions and you get out of the earth, water, fire, and wind, coarse elements. And then you come into a set of consciousnesses that connect to pure light and pure space. And you have a realm, you have a layer of awareness that is pure moonlit sky. There's no moon, it's not like moon and then you have a sky, it's the sky is filled with moonlight. It's like a whitish, you know, mellow light. Then you have a much hotter realm of pure sunlight, sunlit sky. And then you have a very strange realm of dark-lit sky, you know, like midnight sky, absolute pitch black, but so black it's shiny black. It's shiny dark. It's like, I think it's something like dark matter and dark energy. You know, some woman in Oxbridge, I don't remember Oxford or Cambridge, discovered that 99% of the world is made of dark matter. That's like yin with a vengeance, man. All those yang men thought they were all their light and they were zipping around with their photons. And finally, the whole thing is held together by 99% of dark matter. I love it. But of course, they don't know what it is. They haven't found it yet. And they're like building subways under the ground in Switzerland and shooting things around and hoping to find something. So that's, but anyway, this is dark layer. And that's the layer that we lose, where you lose, when you go into your subtle mind, that layer is right on the bridge of losing consciousness. And so it's almost like a conscious unconsciousness. But then beneath, then, so that's the subtle mind, those three layers. And we go into those when we sleep, actually. And if you become more conscious through meditating, you can reach those layers, actually. And that's your subtle mind. And the body of that is this winds, drops, and or energies, drops, and channels, nerve channels. And then the extremely subtle body-mind is something called the indestructible drop, which is a very subtle kind of energy that in a live human or a live animal is only in the heart center. And it's tied up in a knot there. And there's a knot in this. It's in the central nervous, central channel, but that channel is knotted up by a special six-fold knot, they say. And the mind of that is called the mind of clear light. So it's really another translation of it is transparency. So I call these luminance, radiance, immanence, immanence with an I, immanence, and transparency. And that extremely subtle body-mind, in that extremely subtle body-mind level, mind and matter are not different, actually. Which, in one way, would make the materialist reductionists of the modern secular scientists very, very happy. Because they could say, yes, well, you see, mind is matter. But then they're not happy, because then also matter is mind. So that, because you can, and all forms of theory that are reductionists, that see matter as mind or mind as matter, are only relational hypotheses valid within a certain perspective. There's no absolute dogma in Buddhism, except that there is no absolute. The negation is an absolute dogma. So this is Buddhist physics, actually. So this is just more elaborating on John's question. And so when you die, this knot unravels itself in the heart center and other knots in the rest of the nervous system, actually. There's four other knots, important knots, in the central channel. And then this indestructible drop of extremely subtle energy and clear light awareness, transparency awareness, leaves its association with the coarse body and the coarse nervous system, both subtle and coarse. And then that's the soul. And it's just like, in a way, we have a simulation of that experience when we dream, when we sleep at night. Every night that we sleep, we go all the way to the clear light, to the extremely subtle body-mind. But because of the dark-lit space, the immanent space, we lose consciousness in the immanent space, so we never are consciously aware of the transparency level of our being. If it takes a Buddha to become consciously aware of the transparency level of the being, that is what a Buddha is aware of, that level. That transparency level is where the Tathagata is. And that, because, and when you're there, then everything is transparent, so you realize you are always there, and it is everywhere, actually. Even though, it's in a sense, when you go in there, it's expressed in one way, spatially, as if you're withdrawing into a sort of some kind of absolute center. But, you know, an absolute center point is a point with no dimension. It's like a zero, and so then it's everywhere, equally. And it's not nothing. The nothing is seeming in place of unconsciousness is the immanence level of the subtle mind. That's what seems like nothing. And that's what fools people into thinking that when they die, they're just going to go there and then it's just going to be endless sleep. How many cemeteries are called heavenly rest, you know?
So far? Eternal rest.
In New Jersey, Long Island. So that's why there is rebirth. That's what gets reborn. Now, in exoteric Buddhism, they don't really talk much about that. It's more in the sort of more advanced levels in Buddhist teaching that they talk about that. The reason they don't is that people without a certain level of understanding would then feel that that sense that they have of having an absolute separated entity that's them, that's apart from the whole universe, would then attach itself to that notion. Do you follow me? And then they would get into that fixed thing, like the barcode that's the absolute you, you know, or the absolute gene that's you, or the whatever it is. And then you would be stuck with an ideological support for the ignorant feeling of the self as separate from the rest of the world, which then dooms you to lose out to the rest of the world constantly, which is the root of suffering. You know? The cause of the second noble truth, the cause of suffering, is the feeling of being an absolute thing different from everything else, which we all have, and unless we're enlightened. And that feeling of being this absolute us is then makes our life untenable because you can't compete with the universe. Forever. You can become president or Supreme Court Justice or, you know, emperor or something for a while, you know, but or a god, actually. You can become a god, but you'll lose out in the long run because there's other gods, there's other, et cetera. It's infinite, you know. When you're hiking tomorrow, this is the challenge, the challenge is I complain. I feel like I lack a lot of things. This world doesn't suit me. It's not the way I want it to be. And I can't really do much myself because I have to worry about trying to fix the world. And so I'm not going to pay attention to this or take care of that because the world doesn't let me. But according to the vision of the Vimalakirti and the vision of Shakyamuni in the Vimalakirti, this world, my situation is perfect for me to evolve optimally toward my highest potential realization of my highest potential. And that comes from my faith in the compassion of a Buddha. If there is such a thing as a Buddha, and if that being, when became a Buddha in this world, 2,500 years ago, became everyone, felt himself to be everyone, like all of us are limbs of the one body of life. So it isn't like I'm subordinate to him, like I'm his like pinky or something. It's like I am also me, and he is him, and I'm more important than him because there's millions of me. And he is me, and he sees me as a piece of bliss. At that time, I don't know what life I was having. And he saw me that way. Maybe I was like a bird flying around or something, because he was sitting under the tree there. But as he saw me there, you know, he could feel that I was unhappy. I didn't have a worm, you know, my egg fell over, my whatever, you know, I didn't have a right feather, some eagle swooped around and like bit my wing, or whatever, somebody shot me with a slingshot. I was like an unhappy bird. And yet he saw me as a configuration of the pure, blissful freedom energy of the universe, of nirvana, and really uncreated, actually, and really not this drama that I was enacting. And yet he saw that I didn't see it that way. And so he felt my feeling of sorrow and dissatisfaction and fear and anxiety and so forth, just the way I felt it, and yet he could see it in a completely different way at the same time. So he was committed, his compassion, universal compassion, committed him to try to move me from my misunderstanding causing my suffering to my realization of nirvana, that the nirvana that I am, I was, even then. And so he, in some inconceivable way, he enfolded me through space and time since then. And I got this and that, and finally I got born in New York City, and then finally I went to Columbia, and I'm here in Myanmar with you in the evening, and all of it is just completely enfolded in the compassion of the Shakyamuni Buddha, and in this case, manifesting as a medicine Buddha, and turning blue with the effort, a healing effort. And someone asked me to discuss about medicine Buddha, and I'll do that the next time I talk. Well, no, I can do it briefly now. The Buddha, in that same vision, you know, the medicine Buddha created a vision where at a certain moment he was asked about, he was inspired by seven brothers who came from another universe and who admired Shakyamuni Buddha because he took birth on a planet when it was in a very rough time because a lot of militarism and violence in the planet and shortages and different things and short lifespan of people. And so he braved that situation and went and could rebirth there in the warrior class and so on. And he set up the wheel of Dharma rolling for thousands of years. And they admired that and they said, but the people will have a hard time studying your teaching because they'll be sick all the time. Because there's so much violence in the planet and there's so much scarcity and there's so much stupidity that they will feel sick. So we will come and teach the healing teaching when you're there. And so they came and inspired him and then he turned it blue like that into the medicine Buddha himself. And then the people who were present, they suddenly had a vision that everything in the universe was medicine. Even poison is medicine. If you know amount, if you know exactly where and what, you know. Even, you know, absolutely everything is medicine. It's like a vision like that. Instead of seeing this is safe and this isn't, you know, like we normally do, everything is perfect. But of course you have to understand it exactly proportion and exactly what, you know. And so then he taught this amazing text that came down in India and the root of Ayurveda, actually, which the Hindus have, and the Buddhist medicine, which is what really spread in India, because the Brahmins couldn't really spread medicine because they didn't like to touch the lower caste people, and they didn't want to go and examine them, and they, whatever, you know. So they didn't. So it really was developed, which they have forgotten now in India, but it was developed by the Buddhist monastic scholars, you know. And the Tibetans have it, marvelous version of it, which is what this place is dedicated to. So if whenever you're not well, or you know someone who's not well, if you learn about medicine Buddha, and you learn the mantra Om Baishajya Baishajya Maha Baishajya Raja Samudgate Swaha, and you think of medicine Buddha sort of in the sky, and his blue light rays flowing down with healing energy, and like a sapphire blue, or a lapis blue, or a cobalt blue, and this energy is then nourishing whatever, fixing the liver or the kidney or the spleen or the pancreas or the whatever it is, the heart, the lungs, then that's a wonderful thing to do. And the person who's sick, they say, Om Baishajya Baishajya Maha Baishajya, although the Tibetans pronounce it Bekhanze. So in a way, I don't know, but I'm making a crime restoring the Sanskrit. Om Bekhanze Bekhanze Maha Bekhanze Samudgate Swaha. Mahabhikanzi Raja Samadgati Swaha. Baishajya Baishajya Mahabhaishajya. I like the Baishajya, it's softer. Instead of Bhikkhanzi. Baishajya Baishajya Mahabhaishajya Baishajya Raja Samadgati Swaha. That's about medicine Buddha.
Aloha, greetings, and salutations, podcast wallas. This is podcast producer Justin Stone Diaz, and I'd like to welcome you to this episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast. This two-part episode was recorded at the annual Hiking in the Catskills Retreat, held annually at Menla Mountain Retreat and led by Robert Thurman and Tibet House staff. This All Levels program is an exploration of Buddhism, hiking, and our connections to nature held at Menla Mountain Retreat in the heart of the Catskills Park in Venetia, New York. To learn more about this annual program led by Robert Thurman and Tibet House Menla staff, please visit the Menla website. This year, we have a wonderful hiking volunteering opportunity. To learn more about our hiking volunteer weekend, please visit menla.org. It's a great way to relax and recharge while exploring the connections of Buddhism, nature, and the interdependent nature of reality, while giving back to the Tibet House U.S. Menla community, helping us rebuild and restore the trails that connect the Menla property with the wider Catskills Park. Your attendance at Menla programs and your online participation listening to this podcast and watching Tibet House videos on the Tibet House YouTube channel help support the Tibet House mission of presenting and preserving Tibetan culture in the West. To learn more about the work and mission of Tibet House US, please visit their website at tibethouse.us. The Bob Thurman Podcast is brought to you in part through the generous support of the Tibet House US membership community and listeners like you. To learn more about the benefits of Tibet House membership, including VIP invites to the annual Carnegie Hall concert led by Philip Glass, happening February 26th in New York City. Music for the Bob Thurman Podcast is generously supplied by our dear friend Tenzing Chogyal. To learn more about the work and music of Tenzing Chogyal, please visit his website at tenzingchogyal.com. And now, back to Bob in the second half of this week's episode, in which he explores the rich medicine tradition of Buddhism and how it relates to the work of Tibet House US and Menla Mountain Retreat. Thanks for tuning in, and hope to hear from you soon. Tashi Dilek.
So if whenever you're not well, or you know someone who's not well, if you learn about Medicine Buddha, and you learn the mantra Om Baishajya Baishajya Maha Baishajya Raja Samudgati Swaha, and you think of Medicine Buddha sort of in the sky, and his blue light rays flowing down with healing energy, and like a sapphire blue, or a lapis blue, or a cobalt blue, and this energy is then nourishing whatever, fixing the liver or the kidney or the spleen or the pancreas or the whatever it is, the heart, the lungs, then that's a wonderful thing to do. And the person who's sick, they say, Om Baishajya Baishajya Maha Baishajya, although the Tibetans pronounce it Pekanze. So in a way, I don't know, but I'm making a crime restoring the Sanskrit. Om Pekanze Pekanze Maha Pekanze Samudgati Swaha. Mahabhikanze Raja Samadgati Swaha. Om Baishajya Baishajya Mahabhaishajya. I like the Baishajya, it's softer. Instead of Bhikkhanze. Baishajya Baishajya Mahabhaishajya Baishajya Raja Samadgati Swaha. That's about Medicine Buddha. So that's the only, but the healing is not the main thing, because we're all going to die anyway. So we're going to get sick and die no matter what. But this is to make us comfortable while we're alive and to lengthen our lives so we can become enlightened. And so when we die, we will be conscious. Like if you learn how to lucidly dream, so that you can remain conscious through the sleep-dream arisal cycle, then you can learn to lucidly die, and then you will not be driven by subconscious defiled instincts of lust or hatred or delusion into a bad migration. Because we're all migrants. I truly should really somehow announce that to the Republicans. Everyone is a migrant. The word that, well, there are two words. One is jagat and one is sattva. Sattva you can translate a living being, but they tend to translate the other one as a sentient being or living being also. But in the Buddhist literature, the word for an animal is jagat, which means a goer, actually, a migrant, because we migrate through death. And the word for death is chutti, to migrate through death, to fall through death, into a new migration. You know, and so the human form is a migration. We're migrants. Migrants. We immigrate when we're born and we emigrate when we die. And many Tibetans, I think, have immigrated to America because of the difficulties of getting visas and things. Many also, I think, immigrated and were reborn in China, who were killing them because they want to be Chinese to not kill. And I hope they'll succeed. I'm sure they will. But many have come to America, I think. It's a very good way to migrate without all the paperwork. The parents have to do the paperwork. Instant citizenship. Yes. So, and you're Pamela.
Yeah, brilliant. So could you just tell us when you die, that little...
Wait, what?
I just want you to articulate what happens to the little nugget when one dies.
Oh, it goes.
And where does it, and how does it find a new body?
Well, it cruises around looking for, if, you know, because of being unenlightened, when it goes into the subtle mind space, we feel threatened being just a vast space. Because we're used to being a separated entity with senses and then things that grasp, you know, and that eat, you know, and that consume. And so we're, and can possess and so forth like that. So we're used to trying to control our situation with our digits and our little paws, you know, and whatever. And so when we suddenly are a vast space, we feel we are this vast space. We don't feel released if we're not prepared for it. We feel frightened. We feel somehow we've gotten lost. We don't know where we might really be. There might be us that's somewhere else, and we're passing out. When we become unconscious, we become frightened of that. What might happen? Nobody's really frightened of just being a vast space, because if you are everything, you can't be hurt. But we think that maybe we don't know what we are, and we're going to get... Where there is a real us that somewhere, that's an entity, is going to be crushed or hurt. So if this is why when you have this biological picture, the karmic biological theory that the Buddha taught, you realize that what is in that subtle mind, the degree of which particularly has to do with the degree of openness versus the degree of closedness and sort of fear and paranoia and sense of separation, or openness and sort of permeability and therefore able to sort of go with the flow, kind of to surf the situation, you know, because of being more open and more connected to it. So it's basically like all of the virtues are like that. Generosity is like being open, like, okay, let go of it. That's generosity. Stinginess is like clutching, you know. Harming others is like closing your boundary against them and then not caring what happens to them. Whereas being ethical, being sensitive to what's happening to them, then not to cause any harm, is being open to their presence and consider the reality of their life form to be just as real and important as your own. Then you're ethical. You know, tolerance, again, if they injure you, tolerance is not reacting in a super separated way. It's like accepting the injury in a way, and maybe not seeking another one, or trying, but not just necessarily countering it with a vicious cycle, etc. And wisdom, of course, is the final realization of the lack of true difference of self and other, by seeing the selflessness of yourself. You know, not just by ordering yourself to be selfless or ordering yourself to be nice or something, but actually seeing the transparency of yourself and seeing what you are as a total interconnection with everyone else. That's what wisdom is, the final one. And meditation is concentration that is just to deepen that wisdom. Really. Concentration is not, in itself, is not necessarily that great a virtue. But distractedness is just being stuck in whatever sort of instinctual level you are. So therefore, Buddhist psychology doesn't agree with Freud that the subconscious must always remain unconscious. Did you notice when he said about the Tathagata, there is no unconsciousness, there's no subconscious, meaning that all instincts have been transmuted into pure altruism, pure love, pure freedom, pure openness, pure givingness. So then at that time, the ultimate state of that is where that pure openness is aware of the fact that the universe is open and everybody is one, and it is a nirvanic oneness. It's a blissful oneness. And it's just all a play of bliss. It's like an ocean of bliss, the whole thing. That's the ultimate awareness. And but then within that awareness, then there's these inconvenient bubblings, which are the other beings with which you're one with, and they don't think you're one, and they're freaking out. And yet you're one with their freaking out process. So then you automatically want to calm that. So you automatically, you fold that turbulence, that whirlpool of like, I'm different and I don't want the rest of this ocean, into sort of calming it down and like, it'll be all right, you know, it's not bad, you know, we can connect. We're in the same currents, it's all right, you know what I mean? We're all one. So you know, in the Book of the Dead, there's a, when the, in the out-of-body death clear light, it's called the clear light of the death, and that's where they say, the objective clear light is the mother, all good mother, Samantabhadra mother, and the awareness of that is the father. And so your awareness expanding into infinity is the union of father mother of reality. You know, it's nirvana as a blissful union, as the supremely blissful union, eternal and blissful, and. Don't be afraid of it, type of thing, they say. But then they go on with the Book of the Dead and say, well, you're not used to that. Instead, you wanted to assert traction. You wanted to reproduce a body like you had, or you were attracted to some sort of animal body or some other kind of body because it fit with your degree. Like someone who's very violent, they might really like a tiger body or a rhinoceros body or something. You know, they might feel that that's like a good as a tank, you know, that I used to drive around in, running over people in Iraq, you know. So I'll be a tank, you know. I'll be born as a tank. You know? And so that's really dangerous. So because of that, therefore, in cultures with that biology, there's all these meditation centers. There's all these Buddhist monasteries, and people become nuns and monks, and it becomes like anybody who can, they think that's a great thing to support them to do. And their family will support them. They don't think it's useless because they're aware of being migrants, they're aware that they could die any time, and they're aware that when they die, it is this subtle, super subtle body mind that will determine their ongoing existence. It's like that's their passport, that's their ticket, that's their booking. Is the quality of that, that's what they will seek, is what they will be like. And they will find the positive when they are positive. Do you follow me? If they're carrying negativity, they'll be in trouble.
So even having a relative who's a monk can help you?
If you can have a what?
Even if your uncle is a monk?
They think that might help you. Yeah, sure. Sure. It helps you because you're supporting that. Right. That takes generosity to support it, you see. And that is true individualism, actually. You know, Buddha, leaving his father, you know, his father said, look, kid, you have had a son now. I get to retire to the woods. I'm going to go and think of the eternal verities. I'm the old king. Now you have to run the kingdom. Then you can go when your son grows up. And he has a son. That's the Indian system. Buddha said, no, Dad, sorry. Yeah, I'm supposed to be in the family business and be a king. Sure, but that's not going to help the people, and that's not that good a family business, warrior king. And I'm going to go and become an enlightened being and help everybody. And I'm going to do much more for my wife and child and for you and for my kingdom than just, you know, ride around with an elephant defending the borders. And actually, the borders became less defended because a lot of people in that society did that, and they had a lot of trouble in history. So for the up until this time in history, the societies that have gone very strong toward gentleness, toward realizing that their purpose in life is not to aggrandize themselves and not to conquer others, but to conquer their inner negativities and become a free being inside themselves. Because that's what's going to go with them. That freedom is what goes with them and will be able to make them benefit the world for a long time, because there's no escaping life. There's no getting out of life. Even Buddha hasn't escaped life. In a way, he sees it as never having happened, which is a kind of an escape, but simultaneously, he becomes infinity with it, infinity of engagement with it. You know, Stan has always wanted to remind me of the infinite and the inconceivable. So I don't know what. So that's why those cultures want to put that priority there, you see. Like Manla, here we have Manla, where people can come and get away from this and that rat race, you know, for a weekend or for that period of time, for a retreat. But, you know, those countries had like thousands of them. It wasn't that hard. This is a big, difficult thing to arrange, you know. And there's Kripalu, and then there's this and that, and then there are business models and advertising and whatever, you know. It's difficult to maintain because it's not a priority. No free lunch. This is the no free lunch society. You're worthless if you don't produce. And yet the planet is destroyed by overproduction. We're destroying the planet by overproducing. Because there's no self-restraint. Everyone is... Consumerism is greed writ large. Militarism is hatred writ large. And the Republican Party is delusion writ large. Fox News.
You know, Bob, in Bhutan, the monk body is supported by the general population because the people don't have time to pray. So they work, they do whatever they need to do.
Yeah.
And the monk body benefits through their economic contributions, but their job, their kind of mandate, is to pray for the people of Bhutan.
I know. But that is not going to work into the future because of that. That is the Buddhist model in agricultural societies, where the people are producing food and they're barely literate mainly. You know, and there is not universal education. The only education is those who become monks or nuns, and mostly monks in the case of Bhutan. And now they're being educated in schools with Indian school teachers, and it's sort of knockoff from the British system, but quite good schools. But it includes like materialistic science and, you know, like productivity, and they're developing country, and that's the productivity religion being pushed on them, no free lunch. And then, our culture and our cultural tradition, yeah, we go and like deal with it, we support our lamb, but why? Really, do you follow me? The young people are not going to manage that unless they figure out a way of teaching the lay people equal to the monks. You know, Vimalakirti Sutra is not popular in Bhutan, and it wasn't popular in Tibet because of the monk orientation. It was popular in India and China and Japan and Korea, but not in Tibet, because there's so much focus on the monks. And I can't tell you how many times I've given lectures there. Guys, the monk body has to learn to teach the lay people in a way of respecting the intelligence of the lay people, because they're educated, man. They can do long division in their head. You educated them like that. They're not going to just say, okay, great, we're just going to work all day and then you guys will become enlightened and we'll do it next life. They aren't even going to believe in the next life from what they're being taught in science. So you guys have to modify the way you teach them. And like in one ear and out the other, so far. The Dalai Lama is making some effort in that direction, but it's in a context of cultural dislocation in diaspora, so it doesn't have an immediate impact, you know. But it will in the future, hopefully. And I know the Bhutanese king agrees with that, with me, but he doesn't have a lot of power to change it yet. Maybe he will. He has a really smart wife. Really, she's great. She's so great. I complained to her about the architecture in Thimphu, and about the fact that all the young people were moving into the capital like another urban thing, and they were getting into drugs, and they didn't like to go and stay with their parents. They thought the parents were living, the houses were too cold, they couldn't stay in the village, so there's nobody to do the work in the village and so on. So I was complaining about the architecture in Thimphu. In city planning, she said to me, yes, we need our own Bhutanese Frederick J. Olmsted. And I went like, what? When did you ever hear of Frederick J. Olmsted? How many of you here know who that was? He was a famous landscape architect. He designed Central Park in New York, Hyde Park in London, Boston Commons, many other city planning. But I was surprised that she knew about him. He's really bright. Anyway, listen, I could talk all night. Good night. Good night. You can just think of my talk and you'll fall right asleep. My son says it's the best thing for sleeping.
Bob Thurman podcast is published by Tibet House US, Menla Retreat, and Dewa Spa under a Creative Commons, no derivatives, non-commercial license. Please feel free to share on your favorite social media platforms. Thanks again for tuning in, and hope to see you soon at upcoming programs at Menla in Phoenicia, New York, and at Tibet House in New York City. Tashi Dilek, dear listeners.